Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, June the 22nd, 2016, 1:15 coming up on 1:16 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Scott Spears along with you, and we want to thank our guest from hour number one, legendary actor, journalist, commentator, Charles Grodin. We thank him for coming on. This hour is an extreme pleasure for me because we have a first-time visitor to this program, and he's a gentleman, though, I have followed for several years, being interested in journalism. A famous interview was done with Mike Wallace, one of my favorite people in the 1970s, and of course, I'm sure a lot of you remember him as the gentleman, Secret Service agent, who was jumping on the back of the car, November 22nd, 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. He has written a new book, Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. It is my extreme honor and pleasure to welcome one of the truly bravest people you want to find, along with all the other Secret Service agents over the years who put their lives on the line to keep people in our government safe, first ladies, president, so on and so forth, Clint Hill. Clint, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you?
Doing very well. Clint, first question I wanted to ask you, I remember first hearing about you during the Mike Wallace interview back in the 70s. What are your memories of Mike Wallace?
Oh, he was a great guy. He was really wonderful to me. The interview itself was very difficult for me emotionally, and he was very concerned about me after the interview, and he would contact me, call me, just, you know, like once a week to see if I was doing okay, because he the things that he had asked me and things we had to talk about had really struck a nerve and caused me a lot of problems. So he was a wonderful man who was really caring about how I was doing.
You know, something interesting, Clint, I remember I talked to Mike in the late 90s, and he always said that you were the guest that he remembered the most. And I remember him saying that he did stay in touch with you and that he had called you, must have been in the late 90s, to do an interview on the 25th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. And at that time, he said you didn't want to talk about it anymore, you were fine, you'd got the monkey off your back. But you do talk about it now. What changed?
Well, even at that time, I really wasn't fine, even though I told Mike I was. I really hadn't come to terms with what had happened in Dallas until actually about 2009, 2010. And then only because I agreed to talk with a young lady who was assisting a friend of mine in writing a book. And they got to a point in the book they needed my help. And they contacted me, and I agreed to talk with her. And over a period of time, I had trust in her and confidence in her, and I was able to really talk in depth about what had happened. And I had never done that before. I had testified to the Warren Commission. I had talked to Mike Wallace. But I'd never really sat down and talked with anybody at depth about what really happened that day, not even with other agents or with my family. But Lisa McCubbin got me to unload, and that was really the beginning of my real healing.
What was it about that healed you in that way?
Well, I realized now that I was going through what is now called PTSD, and my talking about it and getting that out, because I had buried that stuff so deeply, it was emotional baggage, and I just was carrying it with me constantly. And once I began to talk and get it out and then write and speak about it publicly, the more I did so, the better I felt and the better it was for me.
Do you wish you had done it earlier?
Oh, absolutely true. That was the thing I should have done back in the 1960s. After the assassination. The assassination was in 63. The first thing I really did to try and help myself was in 1990 when I went back to Dallas to walk around Dealey Plaza, go up into the Texas School Book Depository, look out that sixth floor window, evaluate everything that had happened and everything that was going on that day, weather, mode of transportation, everything. And that helped, but it really didn't begin the healing process until I started to talk about it.
Clint, this book is fascinating. You've written a few books since that time, but this book is great because we go through five presidents, five administrations here, and I kind of want to go through those right now and give a thumbnail sketch of these presidents, starting with one we don't talk about a whole lot anymore, Dwight Eisenhower. How was that White House, and what was it like working for Eisenhower?
Well, he was a wonderful gentleman. You know, he spent almost his entire life in the military, his adult life anyway, and so he brought that military experience and that military bearing to the White House, to the Oval Office when he became president. He treated us, the agents, more or less like his troops. When he wanted one of us, he'd simply say, "Hey, agent." He didn't refer to us by name. He was extremely prompt and well-scheduled. If we told him we needed to go someplace at a specific time, he was always in the car, ready to go, at least 30 seconds before our scheduled departure time. We never had to worry about that at all. And he was really not a politician. He didn't seek the presidency. It sought him through a number of other people who really got him to run. And he was not the kind of person that would go into a crowd and shake hands with a lot of people and put himself at risk in that manner. And we appreciated that a great deal.
Before we come back to Kennedy, because that's very important, I want to go to Johnson. Certainly a difficult time in your life after the assassination. What were your feelings toward President Johnson?
Well, I had been asked to stay with Mrs. Kennedy for 1 year after the assassination. So it was in November of 1964 when I was reassigned to the White House and President Johnson was in office. When I initially went down to the LBJ Ranch where he was spending some time, he spotted me, he recognized me as having been with the Kennedy administration, Mrs. Kennedy specifically, and he was not sure he could trust me, and he asked that I be removed from his detail. And so we didn't get off to a very good relationship to begin with. He was convinced by others more senior than I that I was a professional and that it was in his best interest that I remain, which I did. And 2.5-3 years later, they made me the agent in charge of presidential protection, and he was the president. And then it got to the point, before I left office, he tried to convince me to transfer down to the LBJ Ranch to be the agent in charge of his protection after he was out of office. But I talked to him and told him that I didn't think my career path ran along the banks of the Pedernales River. And so he agreed that maybe it was a better idea that I stay in Washington. But he was a man who, he was really bigger than life. He had been the leader in the United States Senate. He'd been the vice president. Now he was the president. He was very unpredictable sometimes, especially when he was on his home turf there in Texas. He would do things spontaneously. Without any advance notice to us. For example, he'd want to go someplace we wouldn't know it until he walked out the door or his valet walked out ahead of him with his small suitcase and a hang-up bag. And then we had to figure out where we were going and how we were going to get there because it might be he wanted to go to St. Louis or maybe he's going to go to Austin, Texas, or maybe he was just going to go to a neighboring ranch. We didn't know until we got to the aircraft or the helicopter, whichever one it was going to be that we were going to use, as to exactly where we were going to go. So that made it very difficult. He was a born and bred Texan. He loved his ranch there in Texas in the hill country, and he spent as much time there as he could. And whenever anybody came there, and he invited everybody. He invited the heads of state. He invited cabinet members, members of the House and the Senate. He would bring down the Joint Chiefs of Staff. They'd have meetings on the front lawn, sitting on wicker chairs, discussing the budget for the next year. It was a real different experience than what we had had in previous administrations.
that time that LBJ was president, the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., Robert Kennedy, Malcolm X, just a Vietnam protest, can't think of a more tumultuous time. What was that like as being a Secret Service agent?
Well, it was very tense because of all these things that had happened. There was the Vietnam War was going on. The demonstrations were growing increasingly larger as days went on. He was hated by many, many people. And then we went through the assassinations, as you recounted, of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy. And so it was really a very tense and nerve-wracking time for all of us in the Secret Service, not just me, everybody. We had a very tough time during that period, making sure we had everything covered as best as we could.
Everybody makes so much of the relationship between President Kennedy and later President Johnson. Did he like, from your observation, President Kennedy?
Well, I think President Johnson and President Kennedy got along pretty well. Probably not as well as he got along with some other people. But Johnson did not get along with the president's brother, Robert. And so that was where there was a definite conflict. But I think insofar as President Kennedy was concerned, he utilized Johnson in many, many ways because Johnson had such a inroads into the members of Congress. He knew everybody up there. He knew everybody's business. He knew where all the skeletons were, every closet. And so he was very useful to President Kennedy in that regard.
Do you think that he was going to be dropped from the ticket? There's so much speculation of that, if Kennedy had made it to a second term.
No, I don't think he would have dropped him. I think that's one of the reasons they went into this trip to Texas. They had decided that in 1964, they had decided that they were going to have to do some things in 1963 to make sure they got the nomination and as many electoral votes as possible in 64, because the 1960 election was very close, even in Texas. Although Johnson was a Texan, they only carried the state by 41,000 votes. And so this time they wanted to make sure they did better. They decided that they needed some big electoral votes, states that had electoral votes in the South, and they picked Florida and Texas. And Kennedy went into Florida the weekend of November 16, 17, and 18. And then Kennedy and Johnson and Connally went into Texas beginning on November 21st. This is all in 1963. And the purpose was to maximize the exposure of President, Mrs. Kennedy, the Johnsons, and the Connallys throughout the entire state of Texas. Because we didn't just go to Dallas. We were in San Antonio, Houston, Fort Worth, Dallas, scheduled to go to Austin, scheduled to go to the LBJ Ranch. So it was a major effort on their part to get as many people on board the Kennedy-Johnson ticket as possible.
Johnson is one of those men that in the history of time, people make light of the things that he did, the way he talked to reporters, off-color jokes he told, kind of his strange demeanor, the way he dealt with politics, the way he talked to other people. But then on the opposite side, the legislation he was able to get through for civil rights. What's the most peculiar thing you ever saw him do?
Well, let's see. It's a broad scope. I guess one of the strangest things, I don't know, pretty strange anyway, we had traveled around the world in December of 1967 after attending a funeral down in Australia for the Prime Minister Holt. Holt and Johnson had become good friends, and Johnson wanted to go down there to his funeral. Holt had drowned off the coast of Australia. And so since we were that far away, Johnson decided to continue on around the globe and continue on. We went to from Australia to Thailand to Vietnam to Pakistan to Italy. And then it was now Christmas Eve, and we were coming back to the States from Rome. And we took off, but we had to refuel. And so the pilot picked out the spot for the airbase on the Azores. It was in the middle of the night, and Johnson, he was on board Air Force One. I was on Air Force One. Johnson puts on his pajamas, goes into the stateroom, and he goes to bed. And he's sound asleep. Well, because it's Christmas Eve, the pilot, who was Jim Cross, and he was the president's military aide also, he radioed ahead and asked the commander of the base in the Azores to keep the PX open so the people in the plane could do a little Christmas shopping when they were, the plane was in there to refuel. Because we, it was Christmas Eve, we had no chance to do any shopping. So when we landed, everybody got off the plane except Johnson, and I stayed there with him and let everybody else go. Johnson was sound asleep. People hadn't been gone more than 5 or 10 minutes, and I was down at the foot of the ramp, and I hear this voice yell down to me, "Hey, Clint, where is everybody?" And it was President Johnson. He's standing up in the aircraft in the doorway in his pajamas. I said, "Mr. President, you know it's Christmas Eve, and all the people have gone to the post exchange to buy some gifts for their families since we have not had the opportunity to do any shopping." He said, "Well, hell, I haven't either. Let's go." Well, now he's dressed in his pajamas. So I thought, well, if we're going to go, he'd go in and put on some clothes. But no, he just turned, pulled out a trench coat out of a closet right there in Air Force One, put that on, comes down the steps in his pajamas. So I grabbed an Air Force car and driver and put him in the back seat, and away we go. We get to the post exchange. He walks in, I walk in, and the people there that worked there, they couldn't believe that there come the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, the leader of the free world, in the, his pajamas, in the night, doing his Christmas shopping. It was just one of those events that, fortunately for him, the press had gone ahead to refuel at Shannon in Ireland, and so there were no photographers there.
What a great story. That's a great, great story. You know, Clint, when I was reading this book, which it is a great book, and I want to let people know again, it's Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford by Clint Hill. Something that I never really thought of, I don't know why, when you started with Eisenhower, Nixon's the vice president, Nixon runs against Kennedy. You end up going with Kennedy because he becomes the president. Kennedy gets assassinated. Kennedy's vice president, Johnson, comes in. Then the winner of the next election, because Johnson doesn't run for a second term, is Nixon, who had worked in the Eisenhower White House as vice president. It seems like a big stretch to go from Johnson to Nixon. What was that like?
Well, because I'd been with both Johnson and Kennedy, the hierarchy in the Secret Service knew that Nixon didn't like either one of them. And they were fearful of my being associated with both Johnson and Kennedy and being with Nixon. So they had me move over from the special agent in charge of presidential protection to special agent in charge of vice presidential protection. So I actually went with Agnew. But that was only for 1 year. Then I was promoted to headquarters, and I was made the Deputy Assistant Director for Protective Forces, which meant I dealt with all the agents that were assigned to Nixon and with Nixon's staff. And a little later, they promoted me to Assistant Director and had more contact with him. So I had to deal with Nixon and with his staff on a continuous basis. Now, Nixon, when he was Vice President, we had limited agents, numbers of agents with him at the time, only two most of the time. But he was a very intelligent man. He had traveled the world as a vice president and done a job, as far as I could see. Nixon and Eisenhower were not very close. In fact, they weren't close at all. But now that he was president, he initially started out having a pretty close relationship with his vice president, Spiro Agnew, but that didn't last very long. Eventually, Agnew had an office in the West Wing of the White House to start with, and that really didn't work out very well. And so then he was relegated to his office in the Executive Office Building, which was across the street. And so Nixon had kind of a split personality. He had this public persona and his private persona. Privately, he was somewhat of an introvert. He even established a private office for himself in the Executive Office Building, which meant that many times, a great deal of the time, he wouldn't be in the Oval Office. He'd be alone in his private office in the EOB. And that was very unusual for any president. Most presidents love that Oval Office and spend as much time there as possible.
It's an amazing person, because Nixon gets caught up in this Watergate thing, which is a hidden aspect of the presidency to most people, what's going on. Did you know anything was going on before it became a national story?
Well, the morning after the Watergate break-in occurred, I was advised by our intelligence division that there had been a break-in. I was provided with the names of the individuals who had been arrested. I, in turn, notified my immediate supervisor, who had a fairly close relationship with the Nixon staff. I advised him what had happened and read him the names of those people arrested. And when I provided him with the fifth name on the list, James McCord, all I heard was a great deal of profanity, because he obviously recognized the individual. Jim McCord had been a former CIA agent, and his specialty was listening devices and bugging. And he at the same time was employed by an organization we referred to as CREEP, which stood for the Committee to Reelect the President. It was an offshoot of the White House staff. There were some members of the White House staff who had been delegated to that group, and they'd moved out of the White House, and McCord was working for them. And so it appeared to me and to others that there had to be a relationship between what had happened at the Democratic National Headquarters and the White House staff in some manner.
What was it like? What was the atmosphere like in the White House when this becomes a big deal, when people get suspicious that Nixon does know, when the taping system, it becomes known that there was a taping system and Nixon doesn't want to release the tapes? What was going on internally?
Well, it was very, very tenuous. I mean, it was one of those times when everybody was very much on edge. You didn't know, not from our point of view, but from the staff's point of view, they didn't know who they could trust and who they couldn't trust. So it was very difficult for them, I'm sure. But we stayed out of that pretty much. We were the ones who had installed the listening devices within the cabinet room and within the Oval Office and other offices at the request of the president. So, and we were the ones who controlled the tapes, but nobody else had any knowledge of it, even members of the staff, except for a couple. People like Kissinger had no idea that when he went into the Oval Office and had a conversation with President Nixon, that he was being recorded, every word he said. He did not was not fully aware of that. And so it was one of those times where I don't think any of them really trusted each other. They were walking on pins and needles.
When Nixon is going out and denying this before the tapes are released, you knew the tapes were there, and I don't know if you were around when these conversations were happening, but did you know, or did other Secret Service agents know, that he was not being honest, that he did know about it, and that the tapes, if leaked, would eventually expose that? Was he talking about it internally?
Well, we did not know what was on the tapes. We did not listen to the tapes. So we really didn't know what was being said and recorded. So from that point of view, we didn't have any idea who was involved, how deep it was, exactly what had happened. It wasn't only until Judge Sirica demanded that the tapes be made available to the court that everybody found out exactly what was on those tapes.
Why do you think he didn't burn the tapes? When it all came to pass, before the courts got involved, he knew they were there. Why didn't he get rid of them?
Because he had convinced himself they were strictly a historical document of his administration, and that he had executive privilege, and therefore they would never be revealed. I really think he believed that, and he didn't think the court would be able to get them, I don't think.
What was it like as he's leaving and Ford's coming in?
Well, in the White House itself is rather sad because all these staff members now are out of jobs. They had lost their positions. The Ford people, it was a shock and a surprise to them that because this resignation happened, the announcement was made one night in August, and the next noon was the date that Nixon was resigning. So that's when Jerry Ford would become president. So it was a shock to them as well that all of a sudden this was happening. And in fact, under normal circumstances, a change of administration, which happens, on January 20th normally at noon, we were able to move all of the outgoing president's things out of the White House and move all the things belonging to the incoming president into the White House in a matter of hours that day, so that by the time the inaugural parade is over, the president and his family can walk into the White House and all of their own personal possessions are there. It's like they've lived there for years. But in this case, where the resignation happened so fast, the Ford family actually didn't move into the White House for 10 days. They actually lived in their little house over in Alexandria, Virginia, for the first 10 days of the Ford administration, which was very unusual.
Do you think, knowing a lot of the participants, that there was a deal made between Ford and Nixon to pardon him?
No, I don't think so at all. I think it was a complete surprise to Ford, pretty much, that he was going to resign. I don't think there was any deal whatsoever.
What was it like when Ford came in?
Well, that day it was rather sad as Ford was taking the oath of office. Usually it's a jubilant ceremony, but it was a little bit sad there in the East Room because of the way it all happened. There were, a couple hundred people or so were in the East Room as Ford took the oath of office and then made the comment that our national nightmare was over. And that, the people were, they went about their business. The new staff took over their offices. It's just a change of administrations, and we in the Secret Service were used to that kind of thing, so it didn't affect us hardly at all, except we now had to have a new protective detail with the former president being Nixon and now the incoming president, Gerald Ford, and his family. But that's one thing about the Secret Service. We, we're there no matter what party it is, no matter what religion they are. It doesn't matter. We're concerned with the office of the president and whoever happens to be occupying it at the time. And so it was just another change of administration as far as we were concerned.
And now I want to go back in our remaining few minutes here. President Kennedy, you were there during the Cuban Missile Crisis and other things that he faced. What kind of guy was President Kennedy, and what was the Cuban Missile Crisis era like?
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis was a period of time in the fall of 1962 when we were on the brink of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. They're having positioned nuclear weapons and missiles in Cuba, 90 miles from the southern coast of the United States. And I think that history will show that President Kennedy handled it very, very well. Some of the members of the military wanted him to strike a devastating blow to the little island of Cuba. General LeMay specifically wanted him to just bomb him into oblivion. But he decided to have a naval blockade that would prevent the Soviet ships from bringing any more missile material into the Cuban island, and that worked. We were prepared for whatever might happen, whether it would be a launch. If we were given the information that there had been a launch from Cuba, we were prepared to evacuate those people we were protecting, president, vice president, members of their families, to secure shelters, depending upon where we were at the time that we got the word, and which put our families in rather a precarious position because we couldn't tell them what exactly was going on. All we could tell them is what, if you get word of a possible missile launch, just get in the car and head west. That's about the only advice we could give them.
President Kennedy is a human being. What kind of a guy was he?
He was a very personable, down-to-earth man. He knew each one of the agents that worked there by name. He called them by their first name. He would stop and talk to them if given the opportunity when he was going from point A to point B. He was always concerned about their well-being. He knew if you were married or single, if you had children. It was just a very pleasant atmosphere that we worked in during those days. It was very, very nice to be there, and you just had a feeling that you were part of the, almost like part of the family, but not quite. We didn't have any social interaction, but other than that, we were pretty close.
Take me back to November 22nd, 1963. What happened that day?
Well, you know, we had been in Texas. We came into Texas on the 21st and gone to San Antonio, Houston, and then Fort Worth to stay overnight. So on the 22nd, we woke up in Fort Worth. And there was a breakfast that morning in a hotel, and then we were going to go over to Dallas, and we were going to fly there on Air Force One, which was something you would not normally do. You normally would drive it so close. But they wanted a photograph of President Mrs. Kennedy coming off the rear of Air Force One in Dallas. And so we flew to Dallas to Love Field, got off the plane. They had their usual reception committee. It was a large crowd at the airport. The president saw them, went over, shook hands. Mrs. Kennedy accompanied him. We had flown in special Secret Service motor vehicles to use in the motorcade because it was going to be a slow, open, total exposure motorcade through the streets of Dallas. And so we got them in what was called SS-100X, a Secret Service car. Drove from Love Field down in through the city. Our destination was the Trade Mart, but we had to go through the downtown section of Dallas. They wanted us to go down Main Street. We got there. The crowds were extremely large, 15, 20 deep on both sides of the street. People hanging out of windows, on rooftops, on fire escapes, any place they could be to get a better view of the president and Mrs. Kennedy. They were, for the most part, they were extremely exuberant, boisterous, but very, very friendly. And so we traveled down Main Street, and because the driver of the president's car was keeping the car to the left-hand side of the street, the president was in the right rear, so that kept the president away from the crowd. But Mrs. Kennedy was in a left rear seat, so she was now right up against the crowd when the driver did this. So I would get up on the back of the car to be as close to her as I could to prevent anything from happening. I did that about four or five times down Main Street, and we got to the end of Main. We had to turn right on Houston. and then go left on Elm because we had to get on the Stemmons Freeway to get to the trademark where the president was going to speak. Well, when we went right on Houston and then left on Elm, that put us right in front of a building in Dealey Plaza called the Texas School Book Depository. When we went down Houston, we, the agents in a follow-up car, which is the car immediately behind the presidential vehicle, scanned that building visually, and we saw that there were about three windows open on the side of the building facing the street that we were on. But there was nothing unusual indicated in any of those windows. And so we turned left on Elm. We were going down the street. I was on the left-hand side of the follow-up car. Outside on the running board, I was scanning the area to the left where there was a grassy area with a few people. There was a triple underpass in front of us. I was looking at that to see if it was covered by police, and it was on top of, on the railroad tracks. And all of a sudden, there was an explosive noise over my right shoulder. I didn't recognize it as a gunshot at first. I thought it was a firecracker. So I turned toward that noise to see if I could identify what it was or where it came from. But as I turned, my eyes had to cross the back of the president's car, and I saw the president make a movement that was very unusual. He grabbed at his throat, and he started to fall to his left. I realized at that point that this had to have been a gunshot, and so I jumped from my position on the follow-up car, running toward the presidential vehicle with the intention of getting up on top of the rear of the car to form a shield or a barrier there to protect both President and Mrs. Kennedy. Just as I approached the car, a third shot rang out, and it hit the president in the head, and it turned out to be the fatal wound. About that time, I started up on the back of the car, and then Mrs. Kennedy came up on the trunk. She was trying to grasp some of the material that had come off the president's head when he was hit in the head by this bullet. I grabbed her and put her in the back seat, and when I did that, the president's body fell to its left into her lap. The right side of his face was up. His eyes were fixed. There's a hole in the skull. I could see that most of the brain matter was gone. So I assumed it was a fatal wound. I turned. I gave a thumbs down to the follow-up car crew and screamed at the driver of the presidential car to get us to a hospital. And he accelerated, and we started out. And following the chief of police from Dallas, Chief Curry, he led us to a Parkland hospital at speeds of upwards over 60, sometimes up maybe 80 miles an hour. And I was hanging on for dear life up on top of the back of the car so that nothing further could happen to either President or Mrs. Kennedy.
Clint, in that famous interview with Mike Wallace in the 1970s, you said the monkey that was on your back was that if you had reacted a few seconds earlier, you believe maybe that wouldn't have happened. What do you believe now?
Well, I could not have reacted much faster than I actually did. I now understand that. That I reacted right after the first shot was fired. As soon as I visually realized what had happened, I reacted. I would have had to have reacted much quicker in order to get there to take that third shot, but that's what I should have been able to do. That was my job, to be up there and to form that shield and be the recipient of the bullet, not the president. We were there to protect him, and we failed to do so on that day.
That being said, when you recount that and say that today, what emotions do you have?
Well, I still feel that sense of failure and that sense of guilt somewhat, that we were not able to fulfill our responsibility, which was to protect the president. I realize after having gone back to Dealey Plaza and looking at the area that I did everything I could that day, considering the circumstances, the time frame, everything else, and the fact that all the advantages had gone to the shooter that day. We didn't have any. And so that's somewhat helpful to me, but it still doesn't erase completely that sense of failure and guilt.
So many people, this has become the head conspiracy theory story of our time. A lot of people say, why was there no top when he wasn't very well liked in Texas? Why weren't the Secret Service closer? What did happen? Why was a situation created that could happen?
Well, first of all, using that car, 100X, the president had issued a decree earlier in the administration that whenever he used that car, and it was going to be used for a parade situation like this, the top would be off. There were only two circumstances when the top would be on. If it were raining, or if the wind was blowing enough and Mrs. Kennedy was with him and it would mess up her hair, then you could have the top on. But neither of those two things existed on this day. Secondly, this trip was for maximum exposure. That's the reason they went to Texas, was to allow all these people, all these Texans, to view them, get that sense that they were close to the president. That's why he did not want us up on top of the car with him. He felt that that was a sign that there was a barrier between himself and the people, and he didn't want that to be the case. He told us at one point that when we hovered over him, the people have that feeling there's a barrier, that he said that he couldn't get elected dog catcher unless he had that exposure and that feeling with the people that he was one of them.
Do you believe that it was Lee Harvey Oswald and Lee Harvey Oswald alone?
Yes, I have no... There's nothing else to indicate to me that there was anybody else involved other than Lee Harvey Oswald. He acted alone. He fired three shots. They were the only three shots fired that day. And that's what happened in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963.
Why is it so hard for people to believe that? What is the definitive evidence in your mind that says he was the guy and was acting alone?
Well, you know, the reason that most people can't believe, they can't believe one person acting alone can do this. But they forget that if you go back in history, and recent history even, the type of individual that Lee Harvey Oswald was the same type of individual who tried to kill a congresswoman from Arizona down in Arizona. Nobody knew about him prior to the event occurring. He's what we call a lone wolf, and he shot and almost killed her. It's the same type of individual who tried to kill Ronald Reagan. It's the same type of individual who tried to kill George Wallace in Maryland. I mean, it can go way back as far as you want to go, and in almost every case, it's one individual acting alone, unknown to law enforcement as having any grievance against the president, and all of a sudden they act out, and you end up with an assassination.
Why do you think Oswald acted the way he did? That he ran out, shot another cop, gets arrested in a movie theater, says I'm a patsy. Why did Jack Ruby do what he did? I think a lot of that stuff is what adds to the strangeness of the situation.
Well, it does for us too, because we really would love to have interrogated Lee Harvey Oswald to find out why he was doing what he did. And Jack Ruby ended that for us. We didn't have that chance. Ruby acted out, I think, and based on information I've received from police officers who were timed that one specifically, who was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when Oswald got shot by Ruby, told me that he later on was with Ruby, and Ruby told him he really thought he would be a hero by shooting Lee Harvey Oswald. He said, but I guess I really screwed up, and yeah, he did. So,
it's interesting.
Oswald was a real loner. He failed at everything he tried to do. He was trying to gain recognition. Some of the things we don't quite understand is why, for example, he would try and kill General Walker in Dallas, who he tried to kill a month before this, it turns out, and then try and kill, or actually kill, President Kennedy, whose political beliefs are so distant apart from each other. That didn't make much sense and doesn't even today. But it's a matter of fact that he really was disappointed in the relationship he had with his wife. He was disappointed with the fact that the American people, or the press at least, didn't recognize him for his greatness when he returned to the United States after failing as a defector to the Soviet Union. he was just disappointed in everything that he ever did.
It's interesting because about 2 months ago, we had the police officer who was handcuffed to Lee Harvey Oswald when Jack Ruby shot him, Jim Lavelle.
Yeah, was Jim's a very good friend of mine.
Jim, good guy, and he was on here and basically said what you just said, that he doesn't believe there was a conspiracy. But people, so many people in this say that Johnson had something to do with it. Why is that not conceivable?
Well, I just can't believe that that's true, and I'm pretty sure it's not. I'm almost positive it's not. There's no indication that it is. All these conspiracy theories are just what that means, theories. There's no fact involved. It's all theoretical. And so I discount almost each and every one of them. Some of them may have a little more things, some things going for them than others, but basically they're just all what that word means, theoretical.
After President Kennedy was taken to the hospital, what happened? What was your perspective of what was going on?
Well, when we got into Parkland Hospital and got him into the trauma room and in the emergency room, the doctors came from all over the hospital trying to do everything they could to revive him. And it was just futile. There was nothing they could do. They finally realized that. And then at 1 o'clock, they announced that he was dead. But they made a maximum major effort to try and revive him. There's no question about that. There were, at one point, I counted 17 doctors either in and out or around the trauma room. And it wasn't a very big room, so there couldn't be very many of them in there at one time. But everything was done that could possibly have been done to try and revive him.
What were the days after that like for you, for Mrs. Kennedy? What was that like?
Well, it was very difficult. There were two of us who worked with Mrs. Kennedy. Three other agents were working with the children. Everybody else now had gone to the new president, Johnson. And so we were working extremely long hours. We had no time to mourn or have any real emotional reaction to what had happened, because we had to concentrate on making sure that Mrs. Kennedy was safe, that the children were safe, and we had to plan for this funeral. Then Mrs. Kennedy wanted to go up to Cape Cod and talk to the president's parents. We went up there on Thanksgiving of 1963, spent the weekend up there with them, then came back to the White House. Then we had to make arrangements for her to move out of the White House. She was given a home to live in by Ambassador Avril Harriman over in Georgetown in a section of Washington, D.C. So we were kept extremely busy. We had no downtime. And then we went to Palm Beach, Florida for she and the children to spend Christmas, which was a regularly scheduled thing. They spent every Christmas, every New Year's, every Easter in Palm Beach. And so she wanted it to be as close to normal as possible for the children, but it was very, very difficult.
Mrs. Kennedy passed away in 1994. When was the last time you spoke with her?
Last time I spoke with her was at Robert Kennedy's funeral in June of 1968.
And what was she like?
You mean at that time or generally?
In generally.
Oh, she was a wonderful lady, much more intelligent than most people realize. She spoke French, Spanish, Italian. She was extremely active, very athletic. She was an expert horsewoman, loved to ride. She loved to water ski, played golf, played tennis, was an excellent swimmer. She was and a lot of fun. She had a wonderful sense of humor. And a very dedicated mother and devoted wife. She really wanted to make sure the children were brought up as unspoiled as possible. I was told her that that's impossible since you're always going to be a president, the children of a president, but she wanted it done as much as possible to make sure they were unspoiled.
Why do you think she never did an interview?
Well, she did give an interview to a member of the press. I recall coming back from we were here in Europe or someplace, from India or someplace, and she did give written or an interview to a member of the press. But it was very unusual. She didn't think it was her place really to do that. She wanted to stay out of the public eye as much as possible. She was quite a private lady. She really wanted her privacy as much as possible. That's why we spent so much time either in New York or out in Middleburg, Virginia, in the Hunt Country, at a place that they had leased out there to enable her to ride and enjoy the private life there in the countryside. She was away from the public eye, and that's what she really enjoyed most.
You know, it's interesting because so many things happened with the Kennedys that there has been this curse idea. When you saw her at Robert Kennedy's funeral, what had she changed from her days in the White House?
Well, at that time, she was so sad because now another one of the Kennedy family had been killed. And she was close to Robert Kennedy. They were sister-in-law and brother-in-law. And so she was very close, and it was really devastating to her. She really lost confidence in anybody being able to keep her secure from that point on as well. And it wasn't too many months later that she ended up marrying Aristotle Onassis, and I've always thought that one of the major reasons was that he had his own villa on an island, he had his own aircraft company, he had a place to live in Paris, he had a place to live in New York City. She could really almost disappear into the woodwork if she wanted, she and the children, because he had all those resources. And I think that was, in my opinion, a major reason for her to marry him.
Real quick here, and we kind of glazed over this, but the Nixon White House had a Secret Service agent enlisting you to assign a specific Secret Service agent to Senator Edward Kennedy. What was that all about?
Well, it became obvious to me because I was the one that got the call from the White House, Alex Butterfield, who was presidential assistant, telling me that they wanted to have assigned a specific agent to Senator Edward Kennedy. And that was very, very unusual. That never had happened before, where someone had designated somebody to be assigned to a protective unit. So it was obvious to me that what they wanted to do was insert somebody into the protective unit that they felt would provide them with information. I, at the time, told Butterfield that we had the people in place and that wasn't necessary. But then I got another call from one of the assistant secretaries of the Treasury, who we were part of the Treasury at the time, telling me that that was going to be done whether I liked it or not. And so we contacted the agent that was involved. I had him contacted by his superiors in the investigation part of the Secret Service, and they laid the law down to him about what he could and couldn't do. And the next day he called back in. He said, well, Clint was right. They're already trying to get me to give them information. And so it was a matter that they wanted to insert an agent as an informant in a protective detail assigned to Senator Kennedy. Later on, if you listen to the Nixon tapes, you'll hear Nixon himself make the suggestion or ask, isn't there an agent we could have assigned to Kennedy to give us information? So it emanated from the top.
Clint, I have three summing up questions here for you. In the president you were with, who was best suited for that job? Who was the best president?
Well, that's very hard to say, but they were all good in one sense and maybe not so good in others. I've always said that if you could take the best qualities of all those five and put them into one individual, you turn out to have a pretty good president. Some are more charismatic than others. Some are more pragmatic than others. So, I mean, it varies. I wouldn't pick out one individual of any of the, not only any of that group, but any of the presidents up to today and say that is the one that we should have.
That being said, it is a presidential year, a strange presidential year. A first lady running for president, a person who's never held public office running for president. Do you have any thoughts on the current race?
Well, it's very contentious, obviously, but that's, I guess, what politics is all about. I've always said that I learned that politics is a very dirty business, and they're both proving the point that I made.
And now looking back at this life of yours, in 2016, we know Mike Wallace asked you if you would have done anything different, if you had any regrets in the 1970s. In 2016, would you have done anything different? Do you have any regrets?
The only regret I have is that we were unable to provide the protection for President Kennedy that we should have been able to provide. Other than that, if I were allowed to do it, I'd be back there right now for providing protection for the president. Wouldn't matter to me who it is. It's the occupant of the office. That's all I care about.
And the incident, the last presidential assassination, how often do you think about that?
Well, the Kennedy assassination is something that every day is something I think about. There's something that reminds me, whether it be a song or a story or a report or something that reminds me of that administration and that day in Dallas. It was a dreadful day in Dallas, and it's something that I will never, ever forget.
The book is Five Presidents, My Extraordinary Journey with Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. The author is Clint Hill, number one New York Times best-selling author. Clint, it's been a pleasure to talk with you. I've wanted to have you on for a long time. I'm glad we were able to make it happen. And there's so much more to talk about, and I hope you'll come back in the future.
Be my pleasure to do so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Clint. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Clint Hill, what a story. We're done for today. This is Scott Spears, heading for the dugout.